The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay, comrades. In 2014, saw, I think, the biggest social movement in Scotland for the last 100 years or possibly more. This was the last year of a three-year independence campaign or a vote and a referendum on independence, which had started in 2012, had been the most boring and tedious conventional experience imaginable right up to the last 9 months when the left actually got involved and transformed it into what became this tremendous social movement in the what I believe you call projects in America with the housing estates and working class housing estates of Edinburgh and Glasgow and Dundee and the other big cities. And the aftermath of that was a phenomenal voting turnout in the referendum. It was about 87%, which is the highest vote ever recorded, I think, in any kind of election in Britain, or mind in Scotland. And a large number of those people actually voted, which is even more astonishing. The vote was lost, the independence vote was lost, but narrowly, 45 to 55. Now, what happened in the immediate aftermath of that referendum was that the Scottish National Party, the main party that stood for independence for the last 80 years, got about 100,000 new members, bringing its membership up to 126,000, making it the biggest, by rate of population, the biggest party in the world outside of the Chinese Communist Party in terms of the actual size of the country. The Labour Party has now overtaken it under Corbyn, but by and large, it's a phenomenal size of a party. The Greens also grew, and even the small left-wing groups, the Scottish Socialist Party and Rise that I belong to also acquired thousands of new members at any rate. So this was a kind of, but the main beneficiary was the Scottish National Party. And what happened since 2014, in a sense, was a kind of mainstreaming or conventionalisation of that big social movement. So instead of being this thing on the streets and the squares and campaigning, it became funneled into the Scottish National Party, with a kind of bigger movement kind of being sidelined or subsumed within it. Now, there have been signs in the last couple of months that things are beginning to get back onto a situation where you have this bigger movement, this feel again. There was a gigantic demonstration in Glasgow 2 months ago, which had about, cops said 30,000 people, the organisers said 90,000 people, let's double what the police said and say 60,000 people. But that's a very large demonstration in Glasgow. You know, the biggest there's been, I think, since some of the ones in 2014, but you'd have to go back to the anti-war demos of 2003 to get something comparable of size. Even more interestingly, there's a small town called Dumfries. I don't know if you know Scotland, but it's near the border with England. Small town, about 20,000 people. A demonstration of 10,000 people in this town. Not all of them, obviously, from Dumfries, but nevertheless, there was, you know, that's quite telling, and it's quite out of the way place in the very south of Scotland. On the field of Bannockburn, where, as you may know, Robert the Bruce defeated the English in 1314, there was 15,000 people in a demonstration there. So, I mean, and it's, you know, the wilds of Stirlingshire. So that's beginning to happen. More significantly, or less excitingly, the Scottish National Party commissioned an economic report, a so-called Growth Commission report, 500 pages long, each of them tedious. But what's interesting about it is the actual policy in it is a complete acceptance of neoliberal economics, without any suggestion of any kind of radical transformation at all. Now that's interesting, because that means for the first time the left has actually got something to pin the SNP down on, because for the last 4 or 5 years, and perhaps more than that, they've been actually having this routine where they make vaguely left democratic noises, social democratic kind of noises, about opposing neoliberalism and austerity and so on. Now they've produced a document which they're basically endorsing, which essentially just says, the last 40 years, yeah, and now here's some things we're going to do to grow the economy, all of which are completely in line with mainstream neoliberal thinking. So, how did we get to this point where you've maybe about half the population of Scotland want independence, and quite possibly maybe more than that by now, given that Scotland is not an oppressed country? I mean, there's arguments about Quebec and Catalonia, obviously, and I think certainly in certain historical periods they certainly have been, but everyone thinks about the current situation. But Scotland has never been oppressed. On the contrary, it has been an oppressor. It's been part of the British Empire, and let me be quite clear, the Scots ran British Empire for the English, but for their own interests as well, because we're obviously much more talented at doing that kind of thing than they are. No, we ran it, we staffed it, we conquered half the bloody territories, at some places, Canada, and outside of Quebec, and New Zealand, and so on. These are Scottish colonies. I mean, this is the thing is built. So there's no story here about Scotland being terribly poor and oppressed and so on. It's true, there were terrible things done in Scotland, the Highland clearances and so on, but they were done by the Scots to establish a capitalist society, as Marx comments about this, in Capital, of course. So there's not the non-existence historically of Scottish nationalism or the demand for independence really has to be clear to understand what's happened since then, because why it's so astonishing and what actually it's about. Scottish identity has always existed. The idea of Scottish national consciousness has certainly existed, although actually only from the 18th century. It's not true that it goes back to the dawn of time or Colgacus or William Wallace or whatever some people in Hollywood think. It's actually a relatively recent, but it's a very real notion of self-identity, and that was always preserved within the United Kingdom and within the British Empire, and indeed honoured and celebrated and so on. The empire is important for another thing, and that's to do with migration, and given that's a hot topic in all sorts of ways, it's very important to say that for 150 years or more, migration from Scotland to the empire was an extremely important mechanism for stopping any route for independence actually beginning, because there was a safety valve. There was a way of getting out. So the horrors of industrialization, the horrors of deindustrialization later on, it meant you could get somewhere. Usually Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and South Africa, unfortunately, where skilled engineers, people, workers, could go and actually have a better life in some ways there than they would back in the slums of Glasgow or Edinburgh or Dundee. It also was a place where the middle class could go and make lots more money in India, running jute mills and so on, then he would have had to stay at home and been working in the jute offices in factories there. And finally, migration into Scotland from Ireland. This is also important. Catholic Irish migration to Scotland, which is massive. It's the biggest minority ethnic group in Scotland, with 16% of the population, all very, very hostile to the idea of Scottish independence. Ironically, the population who are most in support of Irish independence were most opposed to Scottish independence. That's changed now, but for many, many decades, that was it. People feared an independent Scotland would be run by, guess what, Protestant hardliners, which actually was true. The SNP was a party that was dominated by Presbyterianism in all its horror, and if people wouldn't vote for an independent Scotland, it was going to be dominated by these kind of people, not if you're an Irish Catholic, Irish heritage. That's also changed for reasons I'll come on to. So, the end of empire is deeply significant here, not just as a kind of ideological thing, but also a kind of way of people being able to escape from Scotland. You no longer had that option as the Australians and so on closed down the doors to mass migration coming in. I mean, you have to understand this. There were queues outside the Canadian embassy in the 50s and 60s and early part of the 70s of people queuing up to make sure they could get out of Scotland and go to the Dominions, as they were still called at that point. When that came to an end, people were faced with the idea, well, we're stuck here. What do we do now? But at that point, late 60s, early 70s even, it was still the idea of Britain and the notion of the welfare state, the notion of the NHS. We're just celebrating 70 years of the NHS this month back in the UK. So that idea that it would provide for people was still strong at that point and gave a reason for believing in Britain, if you like, as an actual project. What neoliberalism has done, and my standard riff on this is that neoliberalism has done more to inspire desire for Scottish independence than Scottish National Party has ever done, is because it tore that away. It destroyed the only basis for actually remaining in Britain, which was the welfare state and everything that went along with it, full employment, all the rest of it. That's come to an end. And so it's like, well, why do we want this? There's no compelling reason to be part of the British state any longer. And in fact, ironically, one of the things that the independence movement is about saying we want to keep what we liked about Britain, like a functioning National Health Service and stuff like that, as it's being eroded. And believe me, the National Health Service in England is under far greater onslaught than it is in Scotland. I mean, it's not marvelous in Scotland, but it still maintains its basic, it's a state-run institution. It's quite different from how things have turned out in England now. So this is a kind of, if you like, in the pretentious language historians like to use, the long durée of the development of Scottish independence, because it's something that has to be seen over a long period of time. Okay, so the SNP, typically petty bourgeois party, supported by that class and the consisting of its membership, from about the 1980s, as Labour moves further to the right, the SNP makes a lot of leftish rhetoric to kind of fill the gap that the Labour Party is vacating, the ground that the Labour Party is vacating as New Labour becomes the dominant form. And it pushes under, and again, under the experience of neoliberalism, the experience of Thatcherism particularly, but Blair, and the disappointment of Blair as well, devolution, setting up of a Scottish Parliament and a Scottish government became almost inevitable, I think. Throughout the 80s, this was the drive. The idea being, if we have our own parliament, at least then we can protect ourselves from the kind of things that Thatcher is doing. It doesn't require us having to split from Britain, but it does require us having an autonomous government in Scotland. And we can then put a kind of shield against the worst excesses of whatever happens at Westminster and the British state. So devolution comes in 97. It's a promise Boyer made, which he had to actually carry out, one of the very few that he actually carried out. We have a Scottish parliament which starts sitting in 1999. Now, it's Labour that dominated. Labour, you know, initially are the party who was the majority. But what happened to the Labour Party is you've got something that's called Pasokification, after Pasok, the Greek Social Democratic Party. That is the kind of minimising of the Social Democratic Party, which had been the dominant political force for a period of time. And of course, Labour had been dominant in Scotland for a lot longer than Pasok was in Greece. And its support began to collapse. And as we get into the 2000s, especially after the Iraq War, the SNP take over as the dominant force for electoral position for people to vote for becomes the SNP, not Labour. It's a historic event in terms of Scottish and British history that Labour is marginalised in that kind of way. We had a bit of a recovery now, but not much. And when, in the aftermath of the actual referendum in 2014, the SNP soaring dominate the parliament, have the most seats anyone's ever had in any parliament. I mean, Scotland elected, I think it was 55% of the population voted for the Tory party in the mid-1950s. It was a very, very large Conservative vote. But the SNP got more than that in the election of 2015. Now, at this point, we have to encounter the truly incredible disaster that is British ruling class leadership. The quality of British ruling class leadership has really declined appallingly, I think, over the last 20 years or so, and the kind of blundering. First of all, the idea of the Scottish, basically saying the Scots could have a referendum, which they nearly lost. Then the referendum on the EU, which they got the wrong result in, because no British capitalist wants to leave the EU, right, except for a handful of them, mostly ones who are business in America. So by and large, you have the party of British capitalism carrying out a policy that's actually opposed by the vast majority of British capitalists. Well done, guys. This is a truly stupendous situation of Suez-like proportions, or possibly Operation Barbarossa-type proportions, in terms of the catastrophe that's now unfolding for the British capitalist class. But in Scotland, the majority of people, the majority of British people as a whole voted to leave. In Scotland, a majority voted to remain. By about two-thirds voted to remain. Now, this wasn't because they're all in love with the EU, although that undoubtedly are illusions in the EU. It wasn't just because of that, any more than the people who voted to leave are all racists. You know, that's another myth that needs to be kicked in the head. But it was like, if the Tories are saying, this is what the right-wing people in England want, we'll do the opposite, and vote for, to stay in the EU, because it does all these wonderful things about, breaking down barriers. And I don't need to go through a critique of the EU, I hope, for people here, but I mean, that argument still has to be done. That now means there's a tension within the independence movement in Scotland, between the people who want to have an independent Scotland that goes back or goes into the EU or back into the EU, and those who say we want to break with the British state structures, we also want to break with the neoliberal structures of the European Union, we don't want to go back in there or to join it again. The trouble is the movement is split on these grounds. Now, tactically, what that means the left has been arguing for is there has to be two referendums, basically. There has to be one on Scottish independence, and if that is one, then there has to be one of what's the position in the EU. And these have to be taken quite separately, so they can be argued for separately, rather than messing with the confusion that would result. The SNP would have loved to have made the argument, independence and the European Union. Then, before it became obvious, there was actually far too many people who did not want to go back into the European Union for them to carry that argument. So, where are we now? The arguments are going to be heightened because your president is coming to Scotland next weekend. And this is relevant because it's tied in the idea of the British state living up to Donald Trump with everything that involves. There are 20 demonstrations happening in Scotland alone next Friday and Saturday. Right? That is every city, in fact, there's only five cities in Scotland, so that's 15 towns, including one at that damn golf course that he has up in Aberdeenshire, which I hope, so it would be great if he tries to visit it, because, he's bought this is a personal grudge, I come from Aberdeenshire. He bought this bit of historic environmental protected area, this sands that had been there for time immemorial and so on, and destroyed it so he could build his golf course and it's a talented. So there's a lot of, it's not just personal, right? It's not just about Trump's policy. But the point is that this is becoming part of the argument about independence, which is we don't have anything to do with them. This is one of the reasons for breaking with Britain, is the British states, even now, the way in which it aligns with America and everything, and we have to get away from that. So these are all, this is a situation in flux. I'm not here to say this is a the last time I spoke about this was just after the referendum, and that was clearly a stopping point of some sort. The situation is now in flux, but I think we are seeing a situation where the argument for independence is becoming more widespread, and it's one which the left has made a lot of progress on. I mean, the left, you know, did make a big impact during the independence referendum, and it's one of those times when you can actually genuinely say that. The radical left was successful in making arguments and winning people over. So I think we have to do that again. I don't think there's any point in pushing for another referendum immediately, but certainly after Brexit kicks in and the full horror begins to be felt about the way in which the British ruling class are incapable of even meeting their own class's needs at the moment, then I think that will be a good opportunity for us to revive these arguments again. Thanks.
Okay. So this one is on Catalonia. Okay, then I just go right in. Since fall 2017, the question of Catalonia's right to self-determination and independence, can people hear me well? Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Have been central to Spanish and European politics. On October 1st, 2017, more than 2 million people voted for independence in a referendum that was dominated by a brutal repression by the central state. In anticipation of this day, a sudden upsurge of self-organization occurred in defense of the right to vote. As a response to the victory of the yes vote, the central government, under the conservative leadership of former Spanish President Mariano Rajoy, former as of like a month ago, decided to dissolve the Catalan government and charge its leaders with crimes of rebellion against the state. Many politicians were arrested, and others like Catalan President Carles Puigdemont went into exile. On the same day, Rajoy called for new parliamentary elections for December 21st, 2017. In these elections, the pro-independence parties won a small majority, but the polarization of the electorate over the question of Spain has made it close to impossible to govern. 7 months later, the Catalan government and the Spanish state, although both have a new president as of the last 2 months, are still at an impasse. With the limited time I have in this talk, I attempt to answer two questions. First, what is the root and trajectory of this latest Catalan explosion for independentismo? The question of Catalan oppression, although often on the agenda, had been able to remain peaceful and contained since the signing of the Constitution of 1978. Why has it only now, in the last 6 years, become so central to Spanish politics and culminating in a 6-month-long impasse? What are the social factors informing the movement's composition and goals? And then secondly, I take a look at the current debate among socialists. Is the struggle against Catalan oppression and for the right to self-determination worth supporting, opposing, or not engaging with as socialists? Is the fight for Catalan independence one that has the possibility of advancing the interests of the working class in Catalonia and Spain? Or is it, on the contrary, a struggle that can sow unnecessary divisions among different layers of the working class? Catalan sociologist and activist Josep Maria Ententas attributes 3 linked factors to the explosion of independentismo, as the movement for independence will be known in Spain. 3. 1. The effects of the harsh turn towards Spanish nationalism and chauvinism during the second mandate of right-wing President José María Aznar, 2000 to 2004. 2. The failed attempt at reforming the Estatut of Catalonia, the law that determines self-government of Catalonia, initiated in 2003 in response to this nationalist turn. And 3. The impact of the economic crisis and harsh austerity implemented by the Social Democrat government of José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero in 2010. In the period between the signing of the Constitution of 1978 and the re-election of conservative President José María Aznar in 2000, Catalan politics had followed a gradualist, reformist path directed almost entirely from above by conservative Catalan nationalists who represented the middle class. In 1975, after fascist dictator of 40 years, Francisco Franco died, a process of democratization, commonly known as the Spanish Transition, was initiated with a group of statesmen that included the king, post-Franco politicians, and anti-Franco leaders established the framework for the kind of state that Spain was going to be. The majority of the Spanish left, together with conservative Basque and Catalan nationalists, joined this process, agreeing to the new institutional framework of the 1978 Constitution and its legitimating narrative. This new institutional framework involved many agreements, but among the most important ones were what has been known as the Pact of Silence and Forgetting, and the recognition of Spain as a plurinational state with a strong centralized government. The Pact of Silence and Forgetting was literally an agreement to not dig up the recent past of revolution, civil war, and dictatorship. All politicians and police officers involved in the brutal repression of Franco's dictatorship were not only to walk free, but also to keep their jobs. A common tale of blame on both sides developed, where those fighting for a democratic republic and those fighting to implement fascism were accused of being equally guilty of jeopardizing Spanish unity. The recognition of Spain as a plurinational state came with some immediate reforms that pacified any movement for independence from below. In the specific case of Catalonia, the Catalan government known as Generalitat, which had been abolished in 1938, was restored from above, and former President Josep Tarradellas was brought back, literally from above. Like, there was nobody asked for it. For him back. The first election of the Generalitat was won decisively by Jordi Pujol, a conservative Catalan nationalist with unmistakable anti-Franco credentials and with a moderate program to gradually gain the ability to self-govern in the interest of the Catalan petit bourgeoisie. His campaign focused majorly on the supposed disaster of the Spanish transition, that it would mean to have the Catalan Communist Party govern, and it worked. For a total of 23 years, from 1980 to 2003, Pujol was the champion of the Catalan middle classes, and his gradual approach to self-government went mostly unchallenged by the Spanish government led by Social Democrat Felipe González from 1982 to 1996. Arguably, the most important achievements of this time were the success of the programs of linguistic immersion in schools, where any child living in Catalonia would learn both Catalan and Spanish, which is why I know both very well, as well as the creation of Catalan language media for the first time since the Civil War. In 2000, right-wing President José María Aznar was re-elected, and the relationship between the Spanish and Catalan governments changed to one of higher conflict. Up until this point, a concrete struggle for full independence from Spain was only at the margins, and it visibly hadn't had a mass character. But Aznar's determination to attack Catalonia and the Basque Country, specifically by eliminating the conception of Spain as a nation of nations, started a new phase in Catalan politics. As a response to the Spanish nationalist turn, a new coalition led by Social Democrats and some left-of-center pro-independence parties in Catalonia put an end to Pujol's term with a proposal to reform the Estatut de Autonomía, or in English, the Catalan Autonomy Law, in favor of more self-government, as well as symbolically, the promotion of the recognition of Catalonia as a nation. This process was marked by a contradictory duality. The new excitement of emerging layers of Catalan nationalists, combined with a complete absence of the working class as an organized participant in this movement. In 2005, the Generalitat approved the new law to be later ratified by a successful referendum that brought out 49% of the electorate and reflected over 70% of support for the new document. But in 2010, the Spanish Constitutional Court declared this new autonomous law unconstitutional, thus ending the dominance of the gradualist and reformist strategy of the previous 30 years. In September 11 of 2012, historically a day of national celebration in Catalonia for very different reasons, an unprecedented 1 million people flooded the streets of Barcelona with independence flags, turning this holiday into a rallying cry for secession, or at least a new strategy for self-determination. This protest came a year after a series of square occupations by the youth known as Movement May 15, or the Indignados Movement, exploded and quickly expanded in cities across Spain, Europe, and the United States. This was a movement against austerity led by a youth that saw no future in the neoliberal world directed from above by a few leading countries. And it had a major focus on the need to build a real bottom-up democracy that could start with popular assemblies in the occupied squares. This is after 2010. Socialist President José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero imposed an austerity package widely rejected by the majority of Spain. the unemployment for the youth reached an outstanding 50% of the population. One of the reflections of this rejection was the Indignados movement, but the other one was the radicalization of the independence movement in Catalonia and the road it was taking. After 3 years of million people marches on September 11, President Carles Puigdemont was forced to respond to this movement by providing a fictitious roadmap to a declaration of independence in a period of 18 months that would culminate in the referendum of October 2017. The strategy provided for this goal was to slowly disconnect Catalonia from Spain in a gradual transition towards building a separate Catalan state. The referendum, if successful, would then give the signal to Spain that Catalonia was ready to be its own country. But Puigdemont and his party knew very well that Spain would not allow for this to happen gradually and peacefully. If anything, the trajectory of the central government was the opposite, one of administrative re-centralization that would eliminate any real autonomy for Catalonia. Their hope was to elevate this newly mobilized sector for independence, as well as to show themselves as the defenseless victims against an authoritarian Spanish state that would not allow for any rupturist solutions, so that then they could get back to politics as usual. But as October 1st was approaching, the level of mass self-organization from below to defend the right of Catalans to decide through grassroots organizations such as the Committees of Defense for the Referendum, swept the region in response to the brutal repression coming from Madrid. Rajoy would not let go. The referendum was unconstitutional and it wouldn't happen without consequences under his rule. But Catalan people would not let go either. New assemblies asking the questions of what kind of state people wanted to live in if they were to separate from Spain made this movement one of rising expectations. When October 1st came, masses of people from Catalonia made the event possible before the mass show of repression. 15,000 National Guards were sent to the region and injured 900 people. Before this harsh approach from the state, no one in the Catalan parliament dared backing out from their role of defenders of democracy and the Catalan people. Puigdemont, not having foreseen the awakening of mobilizations from below and pressured by the pro-independence left-wing government, was forced to carry out a symbolic declaration of independence in October 10th that did not come with a plan, and that led to the Spanish government imposing its rule over the region successfully with Article 155, thus creating the situation of impasse Catalans are still currently in, although Article 155 was just reversed. So to recap, the roots of the new independentismo come from the opposition to a Spanish nationalist turn in 2000, an exhaustion of the gradualist state-led process of Catalan self-determination led by moderate Catalan politicians, and the general opposition to the austerity imposed by the Spanish state already in combat with a generation of indignados. Now that we have these backgrounds, what should we argue as socialists? How is the left to relate to the rapid radicalization of the Catalan people after the culmination of events in October? Marxist historian Tom Lewis states that socialists are internationalists. Whereas nationalists believe that the world is divided primarily into different nationalities, socialists consider social class to be the primary divide. For socialists, class struggle, not national identity, is the motor of history. And capitalism creates an international working class that must fight back against an international capitalist class. But capitalism, in the form of imperialism, also creates something else. In a world defined by the existence of richer and poorer nations, not only do nationalisms of the oppressed emerge as agents of struggle against global capitalism, nationalisms of the oppressor emerge as well and are used by bosses and politicians in the strong nations to justify the imperialist system. For these reasons, Lenin thought that whenever people of oppressed nations organize as a collective against their oppressor nation, the fight can become one of winning more democratic rights, which socialists should always support. For him, and this is the key theoretical contribution, socialist decision to engage or not engage with a movement for national liberation can only depend on the answer to one question. That support of a specific national movement advances the interest of the working class and the oppressed. and particularly to our subject, that's the struggle for the formation of a Catalan state, advance the fight against austerity and capitalism. The leadership of national movements, and Catalonia is a clear example of this, is invariably bourgeois at the start. And what the bourgeoisie in the form of presidents Pujol and Puigdemont seeks through the national struggle is to further the interests of its own bourgeoisie within the global capitalist market. But Lenin also recognizes that the bourgeois nationalism of any oppressed nation has a general democratic content that is directed against oppression, and it is this content that we unconditionally support. In the case of Catalonia, the fight for Catalan independence is one that inevitably challenges the institutional framework established in the Constitution of 1978. And whether bourgeois politicians intended or not, it opens up the possibilities for mass radicalization, as the events of October have shown. But the full answer to this question only becomes more complex when we see the social forces involved in the Catalan movement for independence. Can it sustainably involve layers other than the middle class? This has changed only recently, as of the past 6 years, and most clearly in the last 7 months, where we have seen the mass participatory character of a movement to form a new Catalan Republic. In this short period of time, however, the involvement of the organized working class has remained between minimal and non-existent. But according to Marxists, this sector of society is the motor of all revolutionary change, and Catalonia separating from Spain entails a change of that magnitude. The situation has also in part been exacerbated by the left's contradictory attitudes toward this process. One approach, led by the Popular Unity Candidacy Party in Catalonia, or CUP by its initials in Catalan, has been to act within and in full support of independence as the key struggle to take up in Catalonia. They have centered their whole participation in mobilizing left-wing pro-independence sectors to formulate a socially progressive struggle for a new kind of society, one that would fight for a new state that could counter the neoliberal hegemony of Europe. They see fighting for independence as the first step to fighting for a socialist republic. Another approach, led by En Comú Podem and other parties, which is the Podemos in Catalunya, has been one of non-engagement with independentismo in favor of a more general struggle against austerity at the national level. Upholding a non-committal stance for the right of Catalans to self-determination, the Catalan Party of Podemos has effectively been absent from the grassroots movements that have emerged during this process. They see fighting for independence as a distraction to the real issues affecting the majority of the working class, as well as a de facto alliance with a bourgeois movement with Puigdemont, his recent successor, Quim Torras, and the Catalan middle classes. The success of the first approach has been that they have been able to exert a big influence in the building of a left-wing pro-independence camp that can counter the conservative Catalan nationalism of the Generalitat, but their single focus on independence first has alienated them from sectors of the working class that don't see this movement as the next most important step to take. We need to note that there is a large part of workers in Catalonia who are migrants from other parts of Spain, especially from the south, who might not connect to the nationalist sentiment attached to this movement, whereas still agreeing with the need to break from the Spanish state's leadership and values. Thus, the empowering task of imagining what a socialist republic could look like lacks the participation of what Marxists believe to be the crucial actors of societal change, making this struggle highly unstable as a project of liberation. On the other hand, the second approach of non-engagement has missed the opportunity to influence the new terrains of radicalization awakened by a national struggle against the oppressor nation of 1978 Spain. They cite the weaknesses of the pro-independence camp as an excuse to not participate in it at all, but this has only relegated them to a position of passive bystanders in what has become the largest movement Spain has had since 2011. The left so far has been incapable of articulating a common strategy. Perfect. I don't know where I'm at now. The left The left so far has been incapable of articulating a common strategy of rupture with the Spanish state and in favor of self-determination that can unite both the social forces emboldened after the anti-austerity events of 2011 and the ones born out of the struggle for Catalans to have a right to decide. So knowing this, should socialists support this struggle? My answer, and that of many revolutionary socialists in Spain, is a resounding yes. They should support it, but they should also commit to shaping it. This does not mean that independence should be the main or primary goal of socialists in Catalonia, but that engaging with people's democratic struggle to have a right to decide needs to necessarily involve socialists to take it as far as the movement can go. If not them, other more conservative ideologies will take the lead, as it's been the case in the past 30 years, deeming this struggle as simply bourgeois and uninspiring for the majority of people living in Catalonia. Now, does this struggle for independence have the potential to advance the interests of the working class? The answer to this question is again yes, but the question here is how? For the past 30 years, the fight for independence has been a slow process led by conservative Catalan nationalists. But the events of October have shown that when the movement for independence becomes a serious question to organize for from below, the Spanish state will strike back with all they have. This creates an obvious confrontational dynamic that requires a break from the conservative direction Catalan politics have been taking. The developments of this struggle in the fall opened up the potential for a new, much more radical phase of this movement involving wider sectors of society than ever before. Notably, a strike was called and largely followed on October 3rd, following the referendum. This is the first time since the 1960s that the fight for Catalonia's right to self-determination involved an organized labor fight back, however temporary and small. It is developments like this that socialists should rally behind and help draw the right lessons to move forward. Now the challenge is for the left to overcome the current gap between the social and the national struggles in Catalonia and provide a new, joint agenda that can break from the impasse that gradualist and reformist proposals directed by liberals from above always put us in when social movements from below unexpectedly emerge under their lead. What is clear is that in the Spain and Catalonia of the Indignados movement, the emergence of Podemos as a party with an anti-austerity platform and now the recently radicalized struggle for the creation of a Catalan state away from the conservatism of the Spanish state, the working classes of both Spain and Catalonia stand to win from waging a joint fight against everything that the oppressive 1978 regime stands for. Just with this exciting potential in mind, Catalan and Spanish socialists should unapologetically support the struggle for national independence and argue for others to do the same.
So thank you very much for this invitation to speak in Chicago once again. It's a habit I would be likely to keep on in my life. It's the fourth time I'm here, and it's always very inspiring and stimulating. So I'm going to attempt to make the socialist case for Quebec independence, and I'm far from being the first one to do so, but maybe the first one to do so here in Chicago at a meeting of mostly American socialists. So I'll start with a brief historic preamble, if you like, going back 50 years, because 1968, which, you know, we're kind of celebrating or commemorating this year, was a key year in Quebec political history. That is when Parti Québécois was founded. That was the one of the two parties that have dominated Quebec politics for the following 50 years. And Parti Québécois was founded on the idea of sovereignty with association, so some kind of quasi-independence from the rest of Canada. And that new deal between Quebec and Canada should be negotiated from above by two teams of ruling class dudes you know, discussing stuff and figuring out a new relationship between the ruling class of Quebec and that of the rest of Canada. That was their project very, very clearly from the start in 1968. But in the 60s, in Quebec, I would argue that a majority of socialists were also for independence. And most people who were for independence were maybe not socialists, but at least on the left, and you know, for social justice causes, and it was, you know, the 60s, so there were a lot of strong social movements. It was the time of the decolonization of Africa, like there was that context that favored that. So the idea that socialism and independence went hand in hand was actually quite common notion in the left in Quebec in the 60s. But when Parti Québécois was founded in 68, that whole thing basically fell apart. There was a split, and a large segment of the Quebec left went on the side of, let's fight with the PQ, Parti Québécois, in order to achieve independence first, and then we'll get socialism as the second thing afterwards. A lot of activists in Quebec went that route and decided, okay, we're going to go in the PQ, and that is going to be our political vehicle to achieve independence first, and then we'll fight for socialism afterwards. And a whole other section went completely the other way and said, okay, this is a capitalist party that's for something kind of similar to independence, so that means that independence is a bourgeois idea, and we don't want to have anything to do with it, and so we're just going to fight for socialism with a pan-Canadian strategy of trying to unite workers from all over Canada and completely ignore the Quebec national question as a distraction. So we went, like, in a matter of a few years, like between 68 and maybe 71, the left went from basically everybody agreeing that socialism and independence went together to people screaming at each other, we should fight for independence first. No, independence is useless, we should fight for socialism first. And the people who held on to the notion that those two goals actually went together became a really tiny minority. Throughout the 1970s, 1980s, this really, really small group of people held on to that notion that independence and socialism go together. In the meantime, Parti Québécois failed at achieving independence. It brought about a number of significant social gains. That's something we have to give, you know, to who it is due, and the influence of the left inside the PQ and of social movements on the ground throughout the 1970s meant that the first Parti Québécois government in the late 70s actually implemented a number of significant social reforms, including banning scabs. Like, you know, if you're a union activist, not only is Quebec not a right to work territory, but it's illegal to be a scab. So that is a significant gain from the late 70s.
Okay.
So they did win some things, but then, and Parti Québécois was actually portraying itself as a social democratic party, and they went to meetings of the, you know, the Social Democratic International and that sort of thing. And but like all other social democratic parties, though, you know, PQ is not specifically a social democratic party, but it claimed to be at least, they did follow social democratic parties in the 1980s in adopting a version of neoliberalism that sometimes we call social liberalism, combining the two. And then there was a brutal confrontation between the Parti Québécois government in the early 80s and their social base, which was massively public sector or unionized workers, including both my parents. Yeah. And on the other side of that equation, what happened to those who said, we don't want to have anything to do with independence and let's just fight for socialism? Most of them ended up in Maoist groups. And in the early 80s also, those groups basically fell apart. like dissolved. It was a complete disaster in the early 80s, and there was almost nothing left of them. So then in the 80s, because of the failure of both of those strategies that were adopted a dozen years earlier, there was a new opening to bring back, once again, the idea that independence and socialism should go together. And actually, a small party was formed in the 80s called Mouvement Socialiste, Socialist Movement. But that small party had all kinds of problems. I won't get into the details, but it failed. Essentially, it failed because there was no mass struggles going on at that time in the 80s, when people were massively demoralized. To continue that history, which was not supposed to be my talk, but I thought I should introduce with that, and now it's been 6 minutes. what happened afterwards is the PQ, the Parti Québécois, continued to be increasingly right-wing and neoliberal, and the left gradually tried to organize itself, but there was a wave of struggles that started, like a resistance, a mass resistance to those neoliberal policies starting around 1995. And that is when the first little chunks of the left started getting together again, you know, after having completely atomized into all kinds of small groups. The left started coming together again in the mid-90s around a program of social justice, or some vision of socialism or social justice, and independence. And so that entire current came back. Now the situation is that as we speak, it was mentioned earlier that I'm a candidate for the election coming up in Quebec probably on October 1st, which is a big date in Catalonia. But anyway, total coincidence. At that election, there's a very good chance that Parti Québécois will actually come in third. That's where they've been polling for the past 2 years, and they could go as low as something like 16 or 17% of the vote. Okay. And we should compare that with how many votes they got in 1981, right after the first sovereignty referendum, when they got 49% of the popular vote. Mm-hmm. So they went from half the votes to, you know, about one, probably something like a sixth of it in the coming election. And so that party is in a very deep crisis. And Québec Solidaire, my party, we've gone from, you know, painstakingly bringing together little groups in the mid-90s to now having something like 20,000 members and potentially getting 10 or 12% of the vote at that same election. So the relationship between the independentist left and the pro-capitalist sovereigntists is radically different than what it has been in previous periods. So that's the historic introduction to my talk, which will have to be significantly truncated. So in that context, let's talk about the general notion of, is it a good idea for socialists to be for independence? And I'm going to argue, actually, in part opposite to the tradition of the 1960s I was describing very you know, succinctly earlier. I don't believe that fighting for independence will automatically bring us to a fight for socialism. I don't believe in that mechanical notion that if you fight for one, then you're going to go towards the other necessarily. And obviously, and Alain, who's in the room, actually wrote a text a few months ago talking about that. There are almost 200 independent countries right now, and none of them is socialist. So obviously, just fighting for independence doesn't automatically bring us to socialism. That's pretty clear. But out of those 200 countries, many actually had to fight bitter struggles to achieve their independence. And as part of those struggles, there was social upheaval, and there were very strong tendencies towards, transforming that democratic fight into a fight for social transformation and a social revolution. And but of course, it doesn't happen automatically. But then my argument following that one is, but does that mean that those people were wrong to fight for their independence? I don't think so. I don't think people in Ghana would say, we should have stayed in the British Empire. Or I don't think that the people of Lithuania should say, oh, we should have kept the USSR together. Because those are democratic questions. And governing yourself, if you start from the basic principles of democracy, governing yourself is better than being governed by somebody else, by an institution that you don't control and that you didn't shape. So that democratic notion of self-determination is significant, and democracy and politics are important questions. And there are a lot of democratic struggles, like just one example, the fight for the right to vote. Socialists and people in social movements and workers have fought for the right for everyone to vote. Now, we've had pro-capitalist government after pro-capitalist government following all those elections, but it doesn't mean it was wrong to fight for the right to vote. I'll just give that example. You can think on your own of all kinds of other examples of that. So, because of that notion of self-determination, independence is a good idea, at least in the abstract. If nothing else changes, independence is better than dependence. Now, does that mean that we should always be in favor of independence when there's a movement for independence? I think Eva Maria was referring to that in her presentation. It's not an obvious automatic question for socialists. And I would argue that we have to look at what's actually happening. If the dominant political force in the movement for independence was the far right, and we could anticipate that if they won, it would lead to a festival of reaction, and there would be setbacks on women's rights and workers' rights and immigrants, and if that was the case, if that was happening, then socialists obviously would have to say, no, we're not going to be complicit and bring these people to power by supporting that particular movement. So it's, in part, it's a question of tactics and strategy. But I'm going to argue, and I guess that will have to cover most of the rest of my talk, is that in Quebec, historically, and also in the current situation, the fight for independence has a very strong tendency to come with egalitarian, progressive, and inclusive ideas. And actually, it is the pro-Canadian unity type of conservative, ethnic, French-Canadian nationalism that is profoundly reactionary and usually comes with xenophobia and all kinds of other conservative notions. And the first example of that historically is in the 1830s. There was a movement, the first movement for Quebec independence, in fact, was in the 1830s when it was called Lower Canada. And that movement was an attempt at a bourgeois revolution. In the context of the 1830s, they drew inspiration from the American War of Independence, the French Revolution, and all the most progressive political movements at that time. And they presented their project as being inclusive of everyone living in Lower Canada at that time, including there were Irish people involved, even descendants of loyalists from the U.S. who were actually against the American War of Independence. So it was a broad and inclusive movement at that level. More recently, and I'm going to go back to the Parti Québécois, which is really the you know, the beast we have been contending with for the past 50 years and have tried to slay, you know, as a movement. Parti Québécois also in its first 40 years, I would argue, from 68 all the way to 2007, was a party that had an inclusive vision of Quebec identity or the Quebec national project. It was the idea of a civic nationalism, not an ethnic nationalism. And when their leader actually made a speech the night of the second referendum, on the when the results were announced that the referendum had been lost by a margin of 1%, like 50.5 to 49.5, it was, you know, bitter, brutal, difficult, and the leader of the Parti Québécois at that moment actually said in his speech, two-thirds of what we are voted yes, which for me was really shocking, because it meant a regression to the French-Canadian ethnic nationalism of the 1950s that saw the notion of us being only basically the descendants of French colonists from the 18th century, you know? That's what that meant. But when he said that in 95, he had to resign, like, the next day. He had to quit his position as leader of the PQ and Prime Minister of Quebec, because that speech was completely unacceptable, even to his own base, even to his, the members of his own party. He could not say such a thing. In 2007, the Parti Québécois took a turn towards that kind of ethnic nationalism, but using, you know, devious dog whistle politics type of tactics to put it forward. But still, they went in that direction and they abandoned that notion of an inclusive definition of the Quebec nation at the same time that they gave up on fighting for independence. Which, you know, that's my thesis, that those who want independence and are willing to fight for it will have a tendency to be inclusive and broad. And when Quebec nationalism turns away from that struggle and retreats towards basically a preservation of Quebec culture and traditions and history, then they give up on independence. And Quebec Solidaire at this moment, at this point in time, as I was saying, the Parti Québécois is declining and we don't know how low they will go and they might actually completely crash. Quebec Solidaire is building itself around a program of social justice, ecology, international solidarity, and independence. And with a view of including everyone into the movement for independence. And, you know, just a few examples. When Quebec Solidaire was founded, its first coordinating committee had 5 people on it who were not born in Quebec out of 13 or 12. The first person we got elected to the National Assembly was born in Iran, moved to Quebec when he was 10. So we are not ethnic nationalists, you know, in any way. But we're in a position now, we're almost there. If the PQ continues to crash and we continue to grow, very soon we'll be, for the first time since 1968, since the Parti Québécois was founded, we'll be in a position where the left in Quebec can actually take the lead in the fight for independence and do it together with a social justice perspective. So once again, that idea that socialism and independence go together will become a very significant part of our political project. And I was told that I had to wrap up. With the 1 minute I have left, I'm going to ask a question and give a very short answer to that question, and maybe people in the room can complete the picture. But a question that people should ask themselves, especially if they're outside of Quebec but inside Canada, people from the other provinces, they should ask themselves, you know, in relation to the issue of should we support Quebec independence, you know, if we're on the left and we're outside of Quebec, is what is the Canadian state?
Right.
What is the Canadian state? And the very short answer to that is that it is a fragment that detached from the British Empire. The law that founded the Canadian state was called the British North America Act, and it was a law passed by the Parliament in London in 1867. And so the Canadian National Project has been an extension of British colonialism, and we've seen recently a very clear, like brutally clear example of how that is still true with the decision of the Canadian government on the Kinder Morgan pipeline. They decided to nationalize the pipeline, not because they're socialists, like oil socialists. They decided to nationalize the pipeline going through British Columbia because they want to save it from the resistance of the provincial government, who's against it, of First Nations all along the route of that pipeline who don't want it, environmentalists and all kinds of other people, because they believe it is in the Canadian national interest that that pipeline has to be built. Now, that is a textbook definition of capitalist colonialism. Like, that's what it is. And the nature of the Canadian state is still that. It's still a colonial state. And the fight for Quebec, and one of the things we have in our program in Quebec Solidaire is complete solidarity with the struggles of First Nations for their own anti-colonial fight. And we believe that those struggles should all come together in a broad anti-colonial coalition. So I'll end at that before somebody gets a big cane and pulls me away. Hopefully we'll have more content coming up in the discussion and then the wrap-ups. So, thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.